Hello, and welcome to episode 3 of Hidden Noise. I'm Abby Sandler.
And I'm Rebecca Siegel, and we have a lovely lineup for you. Today's show will start with our go-see, Toyin Oji Odutola's exhibition at the Whitney.
And up next, our editor-in-chief, Jason Farrago, will be joined by curator, professor, and MacArthur Fellow, Kelly Jones.
And then, for the Even 8 this week, we're lucky to be joined by the one and only Thessaly LaForce, features editor for T Magazine, joining us to discuss the various cultural goings-on in New York City.
So get excited, guys. This one's gonna be good. As Rebecca mentioned, our go-see for this week is Toyin Oji Odutola, To Wander Determined. And you have absolutely no excuse not to see it.
First things first, this show is at the Whitney Museum of American Art at the foot of the High Line in the Meatpacking District, i.e., not that far away from wherever you're having brunch this weekend.
We know you've been since the building opened a few years ago, but pause and listen for a second because this show is just as easy to miss as it is to see.
If you're standing outside of the museum facing it, to your right is the Danny Meyer restaurant and to your left is the museum bookshop. They don't carry even, so whatever. Now, directly in front of you is a membership desk. Walk right past it and straight into the lobby gallery. That is where this show is, and that gallery is always free and open to the public.
Something you do not get to say very often in New York. And we get it. Museums are crowded with tourists, the meatpacking sucks, but you'd be lying to yourself if you said you didn't have time to visit this gem of a gallery space, which costs nothing and has our favorite show to recommend.
Let's talk background. Odutola was born in 1985 in Nigeria.
She's currently in her early 30s. When she was 5, her family moved to the U.S., as it was here where her father earned a doctorate in chemistry. And after relocating a few times, the family finally ended up in Huntsville, Alabama, which is where Odutola spent the majority of her childhood. She later went to Cal Arts and has shown regularly in New York since 2011 at the Studio Museum in Harlem, the Brooklyn Museum, as well as shows at the Menil in Houston.
She's been highly regarded for her specific treatment of skin, which was the most compelling component of her first major works in 2004. She talks about it a lot, about its color and construction, how you paint it, and it's an interesting point what frustrates her. Throughout art history, people have appeared in paintings and drawings in just about every color. They're pink, they're purple, they're blue, and those decisions are considered painterly or artistic. But as soon as they're black, the paintings are about black people.
She's often undermining that construction. When she talked about black tools at one point, she noticed that if you put black ballpoint pen on a blackboard, you get copper.
Right. So despite super rigid visual cues, art materials don't even make a true or pure black color.
One more point. There are a number of paintings of black people all over the Met, the Louvre, the Prado, but way more often than not, the black bodies we see in Western art over the 18th and 19th centuries appear in the context of slavery or servitude. And when we see them traveling, it is rarely for themselves. This is probably the most important point about the show. Odutola is depicting black people free to travel, middle class in this case, but other works have been about upper class aristocrats or otherwise wealthy Nigerians.
She's also called these portraits conceptual because they aren't actually about accuracy in the way portraiture connotes.
More than that, they're, especially in this case, not concerned with reality at all. They're about what could be, or problematically, what hasn't been. She's playing off the viewer's vulnerability to believe, or better, invest in, whatever is put in front of them.
We're talking about entirely fictional characters. The people in these portraits do not exist, nor do the settings they appear in.
This is what makes the portraits in the show even more special. There's such an eerie degree of intimacy. There are these life-size pastel and charcoal figures, and you're almost trying to place them, their surroundings, the outside environment, but you can't. And Odutola is playing with our desire to do so, how badly we want to figure out how to make it real.
I hope you guys see the other shows we tell you about, but we mean it when we say you'll be sorry if you miss this one, and it's free.
Oh, and before we wrap this up, I should also mention that Toyin Oji Odutola has also been named the Orzek Artist in Residence at Barnard this year.
Great timing for you, the recent graduate.
Yes, I'm very bitter. But if any Barnard girls are listening to this, see what events and opportunities are available because this is so special and you should not miss it. But speaking of special, this brings me to our first guest on today's show. Rebecca, I believe you were lucky enough to study with her both as an undergrad and grad student, the one and only Kelly Jones. Dr. Jones is currently involved in another exhibition we recommend, Painting in the 80s by Elizabeth Murray at Pace Gallery.
The catalog essay was written by Dr. Jones. She's a really important educator, curator, and scholar that we think you should all know about. Her most important show, Now Dig This, Art in Black Los Angeles from 1960 to 1980, was first presented at the Hammer Museum. It totally expanded the understanding of the history of Black arts in Los Angeles and beyond, and it was named one of the best exhibitions of 2011 and 12 by Art Forum. She was also the co-curator of Witness, Art and Civil Rights in the 1960s at the Brooklyn Museum, and in 2016, she was named a MacArthur Foundation Fellow. They gave the Genius Award to a curator, so let's not understate how important and how much of an impact she has had on the arts community and the art going public. So with that, we will turn it over to Jason Farrago in conversation with Dr. Kelly Jones.
I do feel that this is a special sort of laying on of hands moment in our historical terms, at least, because you were my professor when I was younger. And what I learned is that you were yourself a student, though, at a younger age of Elizabeth Murray. She was your elementary school art teacher. You tell a story about meeting her, whether you remember it or not, but a photograph of encountering her at the Paula Cooper Gallery when it was in Soho in around 1969. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could just set a scene for those of especially outside of New York, who might not remember what Soho and downtown New York looked like for artists, for art galleries, for writers like those in your family. Can you maybe place Elizabeth Murray and the kind of work that she was doing, I guess a little bit before the show in the 1970s, within sort of New York's landscape at that time?
The photo is actually just the photo of me that you can find in iMinded, which is me kind of skipping into the Paula Cooper Gallery. Actually, Elizabeth isn't there. But what I thought about and what I imagined is that she's meeting Paula Cooper around the same time. And what that photo reminds me of is the same sense of freedom, you know, that being in the art world for me growing up was just a fun place. It was a place to explore. You know, there was art. You took it for granted. People made it. You went to openings. You went to after parties as a kid and all those kind of things. So it was fun. I think her work also from that time, if you look at it, you know, she's dealing with a lot of things. She's thinking about minimalism in how she would approach it through paintings. But then on the other hand, she's also thinking about the inheritance of kind of cartoony vision that is part of pop, that is part of Chicago figuration. And of course, she's a Chicagoan, and now being married to a Chicagoan, I recognize that same fun spirit, bon vivant spirit. Mm-hmm. Of Chicago.
And this was at a time, of course, when painting, at least in the official stories we tell ourselves, was slightly out of favor in New York City and in the kind of art education. And Elizabeth Murray, as you write, was always a painter, but nevertheless was always engaged in questions around minimalism and about other kinds of art that called painting into question or called certain traditions. Was the tradition of painting and was the kind of painters that Elizabeth Murray spent time with, were they concerned with these debates or did they just sort of think, we're here, we're doing our thing, and we're not so bothered by painting status?
I think people just always do their thing. Artists always just do their thing. And it's not that they're not looking at what's going on and taking it into account and studying it. So her kind of conversation with minimalism is real, but it doesn't mean that she's grappling with it and she's trying to figure out if and how she would fit in. And she's also making three-dimensional things.
That's right. These canvases are shaped. Yeah. They're usually multiple canvases, although that begins to happen even more mm-hmm. as she gets older, and they bulge off the walls sometimes.
Right. And she made actually freestanding sculpture that she kind of jettisoned that you can look at in, you can see in the Rob Store in the MoMA catalog, which I hadn't really known much about, but it made sense, mm-hmm. you know. So she's making sculpture, she kind of decides at a certain point, yeah, you know what, I actually like painting better. And so then she starts grappling with some of these ideas mm. through painting. But I'd say, you know, most of the people you can see painting today who are still who we're now talking about, Jack Whitten, Stanley Whitney, all these people, Pat Steer. These people have been painting and painting and painting and painting, you know, come what may.
Is it 1980 that she meets Bob Holman?
Yes.
Yes. Bob Holman, who was a poet and ran the Bowery Poetry Club, is that the name of it?
Yes, but I think the Bowery Poetry came later. I think when they met, he was just a poet. I can't use just with poet, but he was a poet and is a poet.
Can you tell me a little bit about their relationship and about the kind of milieu that they spent time in?
From what I have read, and I know them both, I think, poetry and painting, I mean, that's classic in American art, right? We can think going back to the 50s and with abstract expressionists, right? And even earlier, or somebody like André Breton, right? We can think of this relationship with poetry and painting. So it seems kind of classic in a way, their love story of poetry and painting and meeting up in 80. And it's interesting that her art then just begins to grow and grow off the wall, the colors change. So that idea of falling in love, actually, as I talk about it, if we're talking about painting in the 80s, that relationship actually allowed her to grow exponentially with her own work.
And the paintings that are in this show sort of begin right after this moment, right? And you can begin to see as you go through the exhibition that not only do the canvases multiply, but their shapes get more complex.
Exactly.
The way that they interlock gets more complex. The relationship between the canvas and the imagery that it's upon them, sometimes the marks bleed from one canvas onto another, or they get disrupted as they move from one canvas onto another. Although she sometimes uses small scale or domestic imagery, though then again, so did Picasso, the ambition is enormous in these canvases, it seems. Maybe tell us a little bit about an artist in mid-career and what kind of confidence you might see in these paintings. What new things had she learned how to do?
I think, you've described it well. The paintings move from being multiple canvases that we know that are kind of stretched and on the wall, to bulging off the wall, to also not being afraid to show their construction. And even though the paint is very luscious, it's oil paint, so that has a different kind of feel, a different kind of viscosity. You can change it. It's almost like you can erase it in a different way than you can with acrylic. She lets you see, even though she creates these incredible, beautifully painted forms, at their edges, they kind of dissipate. And so she's not afraid of showing you, the edges of painting. And I think that's also interesting in and of itself.
And it goes back to that interest in sculpture that you were describing earlier, and that, you make a very interesting analogy to the work of Betty Saar in the piece that you do, in which Murray is probably, is a painter, always a painter, and yet there is this influence of art in three dimensions, even when this thing is on the wall, or bulging off the wall.
Right, and especially later, the pieces just actually bulge out from the wall. Pieces like Trembling Foot, Despair, and then, of course, there are the puns, which are, I loved, Cracked Question, which is actually a painting in the shape of a question mark.
She has some of the greatest titles in American history. I mean, Stay Awake, is what it's called.
Yeah.
Trembling Foot, which is in the show. There's one I remember in Robert Storr's show that was called Do the Dance, which is something like 16 or 18 canvases that are popped together into this incredible coagulation of just a big old mess, we'd think, and yet it has this incredible architecture to it. I remember when MoMA was gearing up to do its retrospective of Elizabeth Murray, which was in 2005. It was just after they opened the new building. There were quite a few struggles at that. It took a long time for that show to come to fruition. It opened a number of years before she died. These days, it seems the position of painting, and in particular abstract painting, is a lot more assured in the United States, certainly in New York right now. And I wonder whether the influence is direct or indirect. Do you think that you see a reflection of her work in the work you see today?
I would imagine so, because it's a bridge, right? These are people who were always painting to some degree and this whole generation. And then, but we don't really know, or say the generation that's painting now may not know of these artists. And then when they come out, they realize, wow, here's somebody who's doing all these things. But I also think, on the other hand, you know, there's this kind of underground history of painting,
right,
of art, and I think Raphael Rubinstein talks about that.
Of artists who learn from other artists and who learn their art history sort of through studios and through...
Right, and through, you know, this kind of... if we think of, there's an art history that goes in books and it is recorded, even, you know, gets reviewed, there's a whole bunch of art that is kind of under the radar, right? That artists know, right? Mm-hmm. Artists know artists, know artists, know artists, in that way. So there's a chance that people did know about Elizabeth Murray, but I do think that now, and particularly with this show opening, there's going to be a lot of acclaim and a lot of people coming and seeing what she was up to those years ago.
Thank you very much, Kelly Phillips. This has been a great pleasure to speak to you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Professor Jones, for joining Jason Farrago to discuss Elizabeth Murray and the rest of her work. And today, for Even 8, we are thrilled to be joined by the one and only Thessaly LaForce, former editor-in-chief of Garage Magazine and now the features director for T Magazine. Thessaly has also written for the Paris Review and Vogue. In other words, she's at the forefront of all cultural publications we care about, and you should too. Hi, Thessaly. Welcome.
Hi.
First, before we get started, I was hoping that you might tell us a little bit about your new role at T Magazine, not to be confused with the New York Times Magazine.
That's true, not to be confused. T is the style magazine for the New York Times, and it is now edited by Hanya Yanigahara. And we have 11 issues a year, and we cover men's fashion, women's fashion, design, travel, and culture.
So the first thing we have to ask is, what in your mind right now is the most underrated show or cultural event happening in New York right now?
I really took this very seriously and did my research and, you know, looked around and sort of poked my head into things. I came to the conclusion that, just based on what I had been hearing around me and what people were talking about, the Sarah Berman's Closet at the Met, to me, is pretty remarkable. And I'm surprised that I just don't think a lot of people have seen it or know that it's there. And I think it got extended too. But, you know, it's Myra Coleman's mother. And she just kept this meticulous closet of clothes, which were all sort of, I don't know if you can say shades of white, but they were shades of white, ivory, ecru. And everything was folded perfectly and organized in this way that sort of suggested living life by uniform, which I guess is pretty radical for a woman in New York City, I would say, because everyone seems to care about their clothes and everyone's really materialistic and keep shopping. And I think she maintained this closet from the 80s until she died. So kind of just wore the same thing for several decades.
Yeah, it's much less of a thing for a woman to have a uniform than for a man to have one.
It has to be a statement, you know? I think men have uniforms. So, it kind of makes the argument that the clothes are saying something more. I don't know if I totally really get it or think that that's very persuasive, but...
Either way, it is something to see.
It is something to see.
One beautiful closet.
I'm also just envious of Myra Coleman.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And just deciding that this should be something that the Met should show. She's a very special lady.
And it's very different from the way they usually show clothes in the Costume Institute and the way they think about sort of materials in that way.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, it's every day. It's
so subdued.
Yeah, yeah.
Refreshing. So on the flip side of all the cultural goings on in New York right now, is there something you think is overrated?
I also thought long and hard about this question, too.
This is, like, the harder one.
Well, you don't want to be mean, and
right,
you don't.
This is the
no
trap.
One wants to offend anybody.
No.
That is not our goal here.
And so I will say that as much as I love Kusama, I find that the new Kusama show with the, is it two or three infinity rooms? However many, infinity rooms, and the lines already overrated. And... I think she's a remarkable artist, and I think she's a genius, and I love her ability to articulate obsession into her practice. And I love that she is another artist who incorporated clothes as a form of expression. But I think to me, I'm reacting to the culture around the Infinity Rooms.
And the Instagram,
yeah. But the lines and the Instagramming, it just seems to go against what I think is what art going should be about, which is accessible, available, free. I remember I interviewed Michael Govan and he was talking about seeing a Picasso sculpture in Chicago when he was a little boy, and that's what sparked his interest and that's what got him inside the museum because he thought museums were boring. And I've always thought about that because I think for me too, it was art always just seemed very accessible and free when I was younger. And I don't know. And when I see the Infinity Rooms, I think of the Museum of Ice Cream.
I just had a conversation with my brother about this, comparing the two. And it's, my question is, what would those lines look like if you weren't allowed to take pictures?
Yeah, it's a good question.
I mean, it's...
Well, the other thing to note is that in 2012, I believe, when Kusama had a major retrospective at the Whitney, there was a completely different reception to it because Instagram hadn't been invented yet. Or it, certainly if it had, was not, didn't
it
hold
hadn't
the
taken
same
off, yeah.
Didn't hold the same weight.
Right. I remember that. I remember some people, I think there was Instagram and some people were doing the Instagram in the Infinity Room. But yeah, it was not, it's not the same.
No. 5 years later, it is a totally different cultural moment.
I know, and I almost feel like it detracts from who she is as an artist.
I mean, talk about white clothing, right? All of those original shoes sort of attached to furniture and the way she sort of thought about form and clothing and domestic space was all so entwined into her early work, and particularly in that monochrome work, that to see it sort of later wildly distracted by sort of crowds is a very different sense of availability.
Mm-hmm.
So we also have to ask, what is something very exciting and recent in the New York cultural landscape that you are looking forward to or that you have noticed?
So I don't want to get you guys sued, but...
Great opener.
I want to talk about, I think the Harvey Weinstein stories have created a cultural change, and it really excites me. I think there's a lot of complicated issues surrounding the way some other events have unfolded. But I was so, and I was talking to you about this at lunch, but I really was not expecting there to be this opening after that story broke in which everyone felt very comfortable talking about sexual harassment, sexual abuse, inappropriate behavior in the workplace. And there was just sort of a very magical week when it felt like you could go anywhere. I was at a press luncheon sitting next to someone at a television station a generation older than I am, and we were talking about sexual harassment in the workplace in this very candid way. We weren't trying to take anyone down. We didn't want any heads to roll. And I just think part of the problem is that we just don't ever talk about it, and we don't create spaces to listen, and we don't create a way for someone to just reflect the anger you feel after something happens or after you witness something happening. And so it feels like that is now here. And to me, that's a cultural moment. And I think men are now listening in a way that they haven't before. So, yeah, I don't know if that's like what you wanted to hear, but...
No, that's perfect. And I also think it is, it feels very alive in New York.
Yeah.
It is top of mind for, I think, everyone in a workplace.
Totally.
My next question is there anything that you have read or watched recently that had an impact on you or that you recommend?
I think that would be Sally Rooney's Conversations with Friends. I just... It's so fun. I mean, she's a 20-something-year-old Irish novelist, and it's a novel about, it's her debut novel. It's about two friends, and one of them engages in an affair with a married older man, a sort of washed up actor. And then everything sort of unfolds from there. But the novel is told from her point of view, but then she's sort of grafted in these G-chats and text conversations, and there's something about it, you know, the writing is a little lax at times, and in a way, the whole book is somewhat forgettable. But everyone I know read it. We all were talking about it. And I also think she just managed to capture being 20-something and kind of feeling really invincible and really powerful, partly because you are this young, beautiful woman, but also feeling at the same time really vulnerable and brittle and kind of
lost.
And lost, yeah. And how the two really coexist at the same time. You know, you can really feel both. And yeah, I really liked it. I'm also reading Lucy Ives' book, which is, I guess, based on the world of the Metropolitan Museum. And she's just really funny. And I feel like she's created this kind of caper, and I'm not finished. And it's sort of parody of sort of New York academic society. And it's a rare find. So
it's a different version of upper crust in some ways.
Yes, yes, yeah.
If you could be an expert on any one subject, what would you choose?
I guess I would really love to be an expert in, okay, I have two answers here.
Go for it.
One would be rugs. I'd really like to be a rug expert.
Rugs and tapestries, or?
I guess also tapestries, okay. Yeah. But rugs.
But rugs. Yeah. Things meant to be walked on, not hung on a wall.
Yeah. I don't know. I really like rugs, and I feel like when I buy a rug, not that I buy rugs all the time, I'm buying them because of like colors and patterns and just sort of like a very gut instinct.
Yeah, well, now I feel like I have to ask, what's your favorite kind of rug?
I'm not an expert. I just don't know.
Oh, but fair. Okay.
But then, you know, you go to the Met and then there's all this stuff, the warp and the weft and the gold and the, you know, this pattern means this and having tigers on it means, and I feel so ignorant of it, and I think I would really enjoy it. Or the other one would be octopuses.
Octopi.
No, it's octopuses.
Oh, that's...
It is.
What? Oh, my God.
We're blowing Abby's mind this morning.
Yeah.
Why?
I read one of the octopus books. I forget... The one by...
Oh, you know. One of the octopus books.
No, FSG just had a really good one. They're just fascinating creatures.
They're apparently one of like the smartest animals. Do you know this?
I did not.
Yeah, they're like one of the most intelligent living creatures, like non-mammal.
Yeah, yeah.
They're very smart.
I think of it as like a menu craze circa 2004. But okay.
Oh, yeah.
No.
Well, I remember learning that their skin, or in particular the classic octopus, again, not an expert, it is a reflection of their state of being. And that's why it can go from sort of like white, white, white to dark, dark red. And the gradations of colors that they can change are really remarkable. But also just go on YouTube and watch all the videos of octopuses.
Of the one climbing out of the tank and opening the jar.
They can escape. From
they're
a lot
so
of things.
Smart.
They hide in like pipes, and there's one where it's like scurrying across the floor trying to get out of the
really
aquarium.
Wild. Now we're blowing Rebecca's mind.
Just to be clear here, is this the Thinking Man's Cat video?
Definitely. Okay. Definitely. And in this book I read, she describes, it's that nature writer, I forget her first name, but Montgomery. She describes you just sort of put your hands into the tank. And then if the octopus is feeling friendly, it comes over to you.
And shakes your hand.
No, and it wraps it wraps two tentacles around each of your arms. And the suction cups are really, it's kind of like their mouth, you know. And so if you've had caffeine or if you've been stressed, it picks it, like you can taste it with your skin. And it kind of responds to you that way.
Rebecca's so scared.
So I really want to. I want to like meet an octopus. I want
to. I would love to have an octopus as a pet. Rebecca would not.
She just wants to eat them.
I literally think of this exclusively insofar as it appears on menus, but I appreciate that apparently I have been missing an entire video craze.
I don't eat them because of how smart they are. I feel too guilty. Anyway. Where do you take somebody in New York City that you're trying to impress?
Well, Isotti on Christopher Street is my go-to. I think the Negroni selection is excellent. It makes you look really adult. And the marble backsplash is just one of my favorites. And then on any given night, you can see, I think, some of the finest New York celebrities. Sarah Jessica Parker, Sofia Coppola. Yeah, I don't know. And the food is really good. I think if you're a 7, it brings you up to an 11 automatically.
I need that.
Yeah.
Have you ever
every
been?
Day.
Have you ever
no,
been?
I have not.
It is delicious. Where do you go to be alone?
The bathtub.
At home?
Uh-huh.
Gotta love your home bathroom.
Oh, yeah. I mean, honestly, maybe the real answer is I put my phone away in a drawer, because that is what makes me feel the most, I guess, in a synthetic way, connected. I definitely have panics when I'm not able to access my phone. You know, I still remember being on a flight back from Mexico City and there was no Wi-Fi and my palms were getting sweaty because I couldn't check my phone. And so ever since then, I've been trying to, you know, take time, whole afternoons where I'm not allowed to look at it. Of course, it doesn't really work, but...
But it's a good way to think about addiction.
Yes. But I think just if you, no one can email you, no one can text you, no one can call you, that is a sort of kind of solitude one needs in the city.
And hard to come by.
Yeah.
So finally, we want to ask you, what is on your radar for the rest of 2017? Not that there's much time left.
There isn't. I guess the Louise Bourgeois show at the MoMA of her drawings and sketches and books seems pretty important. You know, she is the first. She was the first woman artist to have a solo show, a major solo show at the MoMA in the 80s. I think I remember reading that. And I think also we're so used to the spiders and embroidered pillows and, you know, the sculptures. And then this kind of, I think, shows the thinking behind that. And as I recall, it's organized very smartly, too. So very curious to check that out.
I will say about that show, she has an incredible printmaking practice. And seeing the depth of that as it's organized by sort of theme, not just time, but also looking at certain gestures over multiple decades, it's incredible. And the atrium space is really well activated as sort of a teaser.
Okay.
Before you sort of walk into the rest of it. It's an excellent show. Everyone should go to MoMA for this Bourgeois show.
Okay, good. Maybe also I would say Greta Gerwig's Lady Bird.
I've only heard incredible things.
I was weeping. It was just so emotionally cathartic because it's about a relationship with her and a very tough mother. And, you know, if you have a tough mother,
which we all do,
it just feels like a very honest story and it doesn't have a lot of bells and whistles. It's not very embellished. And it's still so powerful. I don't know how to describe it any other way. Just really, I haven't wept like that in a screening room in a long time.
So we will all have to go see Lady Bird right away.
Yeah.
I think A.O. Scott in his review may have called it perfect.
I think so. I remember seeing that.
Wild thing for a movie critic to say.
Yeah.
And it like broke all those box office records, which is like crazy.
Oh, did it really?
Yeah. I forgot exactly the details of that, but it broke a lot of records.
All right. So that's up next this weekend.
Yeah.
So we will encourage everyone to go to MoMA, see the Louise Bourgeois show, see Lady Bird, have conversations about sexual harassment in the open.
And don't Instagram the Infinity Room.
That's it.
Or do, but, you know, we're shaking your heads at you.
And potentially rethink eating octopus.
And don't eat octopus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds good.
But buy one, maybe.
Potentially
rescue one.
Potentially Instagram the octopus instead.
Maybe just go on YouTube and watch the videos.
Thessaly, thank you so much.
Thank you.
To close, we quickly want to thank Kelly Jones for joining Jason to discuss Elizabeth Murray's show at Pace. We urge you all to go check it out. You have until January 13th. And go to the Whitney, see Toyin Oji Odutola's To Wander Determined, and even go to MoMA to check out Louise Bourgeois. And thank you to Thessaly for joining us for the Even 8.
Don't forget to pick up your copy of Tea Magazine, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Happy Thanksgiving.
I'm Rebecca Siegel.
And I'm Abby Sandler.
And this is Hidden Noise.